TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. 3 minutes to midnight. In January 2015, the doomsday clock was moved from 5 to only 3 minutes to midnight. The doomsday clock was created in 1947 by atomic scientists who had participated in the Manhattan Project to show how close we may be to extinction. They were in shock by the impact of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In 1945, they founded the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists in order to alert people to the dangers of nuclear weapons and the need to abolish them. Over the 70 years since then, the Bulletin has published without interruption and has welcomed other scientists who are working against nuclear power and climate change to join them and more precisely describe the existential risks humanity is facing. The decision to move the hand of the doomsday clock closer to midnight was made by over 20 scientists, 17 of whom are Nobel laureates. They declared, "Unchecked climate change, global nuclear weapons modernizations, and outsized nuclear weapons arsenals pose extraordinary and undeniable threats to the continued existence of humanity." End quote. On January 22, 2015, the Science and Security Board of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists held a press conference, and you will hear most of that event in a moment. The abysmal lack of coverage in the media prompted this radio program. Worst of all, the newspaper of record, the New York Times, reported on the press conference this way, quote, "The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists says Earth is now closer to human-caused doomsday than it has been in more than 30 years because of global warming and nuclear weaponry. But other experts say that's way too gloomy." Then the New York Times actually quotes their experts. Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker said about the Nobel laureates, "They have to find a new source of doom, i.e. climate change, because global thermonuclear war is now so unlikely." End quote. The New York Times also quotes Professor Michael Oppenheimer from Princeton. He said, "I suspect that humans will muddle through the climate situation much as we have muddled through the nuclear weapons situation." End quote. That's the wisdom from Harvard and Princeton, spread by the New York Times. Gloomy or not, muddled or not, you'll be the judge. Here's Kennette Benedict opening the press conference. She's the outgoing executive director and publisher of the Bulletin. Kennette Benedict.
"Today, unchecked climate change and a nuclear arms race resulting from modernization of huge arsenals pose extraordinary and undeniable threats to the continued existence of humanity. And world leaders have failed to act with the speed or on the scale required to protect citizens from potential catastrophe. These failures of leadership endanger every person on Earth. But our message today is not one of hopelessness. While there is still time to act and real steps can be taken, they will have to come soon, very soon, in order to avert catastrophe. Based on their observations, the members of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Science and Security Board find conditions in the world to be so threatening that they are moving the hands of the doomsday clock 2 minutes closer to midnight. It is now 3 minutes to midnight. Countries emitting carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are on the way to profoundly transforming Earth's climate, harming millions upon millions of people with sea level rise, diminished food supplies, and even more droughts, wildfires, and killer storms than we have today. The other test of leadership that we're failing is the effort to reduce world nuclear arsenals. The arms reduction process has ground to a halt. With the United States and Russia embarking on massive programs to modernize their nuclear forces, thereby undermining existing nuclear weapons treaties. At the same time, other nuclear weapons states are joining this expensive and extremely dangerous modernization craze. Let's be clear, there are far too many nuclear weapons in the world, some 16,300. And world leaders, particularly those in the United States and Russia, have failed to live up to their responsibility to reduce the nuclear threat. Either of these calamities on its own, and brought about with technologies of our own making, will cause such grave destruction that we simply will no longer be able to flourish on the planet. Even more daunting, and what is often neglected in reports about these threats, is that taken together, the combination of climate disruption and increasing nuclear arsenals pose truly terrible prospects. For example, to provide energy sources while reducing carbon emissions, some have proposed building many more nuclear power plants. Yet such a solution would only increase the spread of dual-use nuclear technology, and without robust international undertakings to prohibit nuclear weapons, will increase the likelihood of nuclear war in the future. Increasing the chances of nuclear war, in turn, would risk producing climate change of another kind, a nuclear winter that would bring untold harm, including a worldwide famine for as long as a decade. In sum, stunning governmental failures have imperiled civilization on a global scale. And so the members of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Board are today imploring the citizens of the world to speak clearly, demanding that, at the very least, their leaders take these necessary steps. Take actions that would cap greenhouse gas emissions to keep average global temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Dramatically reduce proposed spending on nuclear weapons modernization programs and re-energize the disarmament process with a focus on results. The world needs to be awakened from its lethargy and start making changes. We move the clock hand today to inspire action and to help push that process along. I want to turn now to each of the three members of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Science and Security Board. These experts will provide details about the trends contributing to the board's action. Beginning at the far end, Richard Somerville of the Scripps Institution of Oceanographic Science in La Jolla will talk about the science of global warming. Richard.
In 2014, the U.S. government issued its third national climate assessment. Its first words are, quote, "climate change, once considered an issue for a distant future, has moved firmly into the present," unquote. 2014 is the warmest year on record globally. 9 of the 10 warmest years on record have all occurred since 2000. The warming trend in recent decades is unmistakable. Science clearly demonstrates that human activity is the dominant cause of this warming. If global emissions of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases continue to rise, the severity of climate change impacts will inevitably increase. In 2014, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, completed its fifth assessment report. Today, I will paraphrase its main scientific findings. Human influence on the climate system is clear, and recent human-caused emissions of heat-trapping gases are the highest in history. Climate change has already produced widespread impacts. Warming of the climate system is unequivocal. Many of the changes we observe are unprecedented in modern times. The atmosphere and ocean have both warmed, snow and ice have diminished, atmospheric water vapor has increased, and sea level has risen. Each of the last three decades has been successively warmer than any preceding decade on record. The total amounts of human-caused emissions of heat-trapping gases have continued to increase in recent decades. These emissions have led to amounts of these gases in the atmosphere that are so large that they are unprecedented in at least the last 800,000 years. Observed changes in climate clearly show the fingerprints of human activities. These activities, especially the emission of heat-trapping gases from burning coal, oil, and natural gas, are the dominant cause of the observed warming. Limiting climate change to moderate levels will require rapid, substantial, and sustained reductions in emissions of heat-trapping gases globally. The temperature at the surface of the Earth will further rise during this century, and the amount of warming will depend primarily on our emissions. Heat waves will occur more frequently and last longer, and extreme precipitation events will become more intense and frequent in many regions. The ocean will continue to warm and to become more acidic, and global average sea level will continue to rise. All these changes have already been observed and are projected to continue to increase. New and unsettling research results have been announced after the final text of the latest IPCC report was set. In 2014, scientists investigating Antarctic ice sheets announced that a tipping point, predicted decades ago, has now apparently been passed, with the discovery that the retreat of ice in a sector of West Antarctica has now become unstoppable. This ice loss will eventually lead to a contribution to sea level rise of about 3 feet. Efforts at reducing global emissions of heat-trapping gases have so far been entirely insufficient to prevent unacceptable climate disruption. Unless much greater emissions reductions occur very soon, the countries of the world will have emitted enough carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases by the end of this century to profoundly transform the Earth's climate. The resulting climate change will harm millions of people and will threaten many key ecological systems on which civilization relies. The science is clear. Insufficient action to slash worldwide emissions of heat-trapping gases is projected to lead to major climatic disruption globally. To avoid such unacceptable levels of climate change, the need for urgent action instead of continued procrastination is clear. The urgency has nothing to do with politics or ideology. It arises from the laws of physics and chemistry and biology. These laws are non-negotiable. We call upon world leaders to take coordinated and rapid action to drastically reduce global emissions of heat-trapping gases, especially carbon dioxide. We also urge the citizens of the world to demand action from their leaders. This threat looms over all humanity. We need to respond now while there is still time. The world is addicted to fossil fuels. To limit global warming to moderate levels, all humanity must end this addiction and must dramatically reduce its emissions of the heat-trapping gases produced mainly from burning fossil fuels.
That was Richard Somerville, research professor at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, University of California, San Diego. He's on the Science and Security Board of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. You are listening to a recording of their press conference on January 22, 2015, when the Bulletin announced that they had to move the doomsday clock from 5 to only 3 minutes to midnight. The next speaker is Jivan Carter, senior scientist at the Stockholm Environment Institute.
I'll make some comments about the scale of the climate challenge and our efforts thus far to rise to that challenge. I'll start off by stressing one key lesson from the recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment that my colleague Professor Somerville also referred to. That assessment reported that if we do not make a concerted effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the Earth will be 3 to 8 degrees centigrade, that's about 5 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer by the end of the century. Now, it can be difficult for people to understand why a modest 3 to 8 degrees warming should bring on what is being referred to as a climate catastrophe. After all, we experience much greater temperature swings than that locally in the course of a single day. However, those local temperature swings are a very different thing from heating the entire planet and raising its total energy. As it turns out, it only took a modest 3 to 8 degrees of warming to bring the Earth out from the frigid depths of the last ice age some 20,000 years ago. That warming, 3 to 8 degrees, was enough, in fact, to radically transform the surface of the Earth. That was enough, in fact, to make the Earth hospitable to the emergence of human civilization. And now that same civilization has progressed to the point where its own technologies could cause the Earth to heat by another 3 to 8 degrees, posing the specter of a future in which the Earth's surface is again profoundly transformed. If we let this happen, we should by no means take for granted that the Earth would remain hospitable to human civilization. Yet we don't have to let this happen. Indeed, the IPCC concluded unequivocally that we can avert a climate catastrophe. We can hold warming below 2 degrees. We have the technologies, and we can deploy them to make our homes, our buildings, our industries, and our transportation more energy efficient, and to shift away from fossil fuels toward low-carbon energy sources. And moreover, we can afford to do this. A full-on effort to reduce greenhouse gas pollution is estimated to cost all of 0.06% of annual growth to the global economy. That's 1/16 of a percent. In other words, investing in reducing greenhouse gas emissions would not cripple our economies, nor stand in the way of continued improvements in our standard of living. To the contrary, it would yield benefits such as energy security, reduced air pollution, and improved health. Moreover, it is necessary if we're to protect the hospitable climate on which our civilization depends. However, our efforts to address climate change are leagues away from the full-on efforts that the challenge demands. When countries gathered more than 2 decades ago in Rio de Janeiro to negotiate an international climate treaty, they did so with the intention of steadily strengthening and expanding that agreement. Instead, the agreement has arguably weakened and contracted. What had been a system of legally binding targets has devolved into a system of voluntary and demonstrably inadequate pledges. What had been envisaged as a financing mechanism to support poor countries endeavoring to deal with climate impacts and to develop along a clean energy pathway has barely gotten off the ground, and it's a sorely funded financial mechanism compared to what's needed. What had been expected to be a steadily broadening circle of countries engaging meaningfully has instead been marked by key countries, such as the United States, Canada, and Japan, scaling back on their commitments. When the United States recently announced it would cut greenhouse gas emissions by 26 to 28% from 2005 levels by the year 2025, this was lauded as a historic step and a game changer, even though it was actually backtracking on the target presented by President Obama 5 years earlier in Copenhagen, when he put forward a 30% cut by 2025. Steps seen as bold in light of today's extremely daunting political opposition to climate action do not even match the expectations of 5 years ago, to say nothing of the scientific necessity. The results are unsurprising. Global greenhouse gas emission rates are now 50% higher than they were in 1990. Emission rates have risen since the year 2000 by more than the previous 3 decades combined. Investments have continued to pour into fossil fuel infrastructure at a rate that exceeds $1 trillion per year, with additional hundreds of billions of dollars in continued fossil fuel subsidies. We can turn this around, however. Echoing the previous remarks, we call on global leaders now to take those actions.
That was Jivan Karta, senior scientist at the Stockholm Environment Institute. The next speaker is Sharon Squassoni. She currently directs the Proliferation Prevention Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Squassoni has specialized in nuclear nonproliferation, arms control, and security policy for 3 decades.
Since the end of the Cold War, the world has been cautiously optimistic about the ability of nuclear weapon states to keep the nuclear arms race in check and to walk slowly back from the precipice of nuclear destruction. That optimism has essentially evaporated in the face of two trends: nuclear weapons modernization programs and a disarmament machinery that has ground to a halt. Although the U.S. and Russia no longer have the tens of thousands of nuclear weapons they had during the Cold War, the pace of reduction has slowed dramatically in recent years, well before the crisis in Crimea. From 2009 to 2013, the Obama administration cut only 309 warheads from the stockpile, with Russia cutting about 1,000. The rhetoric, at least on the U.S. side, is good. We have a policy of reducing reliance on nuclear weapons. In practice, however, the U.S. is engaged in a massive overhaul of its nuclear weapons systems and infrastructure. In the next decade, the U.S. is slated to spend $355 billion on the nuclear triad, and looking out 30 years, that will total $1 trillion or more. Russia is also upgrading its triad, and recent Russian statements on nuclear weapons have emphasized the importance of nuclear missions rather than de-emphasizing them. And this is especially true for non-strategic nuclear weapons, which are not currently limited by any arms control agreements. The United Kingdom, for its part, has almost halved its stockpile of nuclear warheads since 2010, but it's continuing to support its Trident nuclear missile submarine program. The same is true for France, and it is also building a next-generation delivery vehicle, an air-to-ground nuclear-tipped missile. China, for its part, is developing a new class of ballistic missile submarines with a new ballistic missile. Meanwhile, states outside of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty with nuclear weapons are not standing still. India plans to expand its nuclear submarine fleet, with the first submarine undergoing sea trials and the second one under construction. It has also tested what has been described as a nuclear-capable cruise missile. Neighboring Pakistan reportedly has started operating a third plutonium production reactor, and it is developing a new short-range nuclear-capable missile called NASR, which has the potential for lowering the threshold for nuclear weapons use in South Asia. Israel reportedly is also modernizing some of its undeclared nuclear forces, and North Korea, as we all know, continues its nuclear program without any of the restraints previously applied under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. According to Hans Christensen of the Federation of American Scientists, modernization programs across the board include 27 ballistic missiles, 8 warships, 5 bombers, 9 cruise missiles, 8 warheads, and 8 factories. At the same time, the gears in the machinery of nuclear disarmament seem to be rusting. 3 years after New START entered into force, Russia reportedly has more warheads deployed now than before. U.S. deployed strategic warheads have also gone up in recent months, although this total is still lower than in 2011 and is likely temporary. But the real story here is that there's no movement toward a follow-on agreement, and none is foreseen in the current political environment. And although both the U.S. and Russia support multilateral nuclear reductions, the other nuclear armed states are extremely unlikely to reduce their own arsenals until the U.S. and Russia bring their own warhead numbers well below 1,000 each. Arms control experts have often pointed to arms control as a way of keeping the broader U.S.-Russian relationship on an even keel. But these two countries, which own 90% of the world's nuclear warheads, now find it difficult to talk. There are unresolved accusations of violations on both sides of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, an important but now threatened bulwark against the reintroduction of medium-range nuclear missiles to Europe. And both sides are engaged in a tit-for-tat boycotting of important meetings like the upcoming 2016 Nuclear Security Summit and a planned U.S.-Russian summit. Finally, limitations on non-strategic nuclear weapons, of which there are thousands, seem to be off the discussion table indefinitely. So in sum, there are still too many nuclear weapons in the world because leaders have failed to live up to their responsibility to control and reduce the nuclear threat. Thank you.
That was Sharon Squassoni. She currently directs the Proliferation Prevention Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Next up, Kennette Benedict, Executive Director of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
From these remarks, you'll see that this year especially, the board feels a sense of great urgency. The probability of global catastrophe is really very high, and the actions needed to reduce the risks of disaster must be taken very soon. We can manage our technology or become victims of it. The choice is ours, and the clock is ticking.
That was Kennette Benedict. You heard the recording of a January 2015 press conference held by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. The Bulletin was founded in 1945 by scientists who participated in the Manhattan Project and realized the horror of the effects of the weapons they had helped develop. They decided to begin a campaign to alert the public to the dangers of nuclear weapons and the need to abolish them. In 1947, the Bulletin created the Doomsday Clock for the cover of their magazine. Each year, the Science and Security Board of the Bulletin meets to decide whether the risks of nuclear and climate annihilation have grown or diminished. Since 1947, the clock has been adjusted only 18 times, ranging from 2 minutes to midnight in 1953 to 17 minutes before midnight in 1991. The clock is now recognized as a universal symbol of threats to humanity from a variety of sources, nuclear and other weapons of mass destruction, climate change, and even emerging technologies. Something else to pay attention to. You heard 3 minutes to midnight, audio of the January 22, 2015 press conference by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. The website of the Bulletin is thebulletin.org. The Bulletin, one word, lowercase. You can watch the video of the press conference on their website, including the emergence of the awful and irresponsible New York Times report in the Q&A session. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. If you're unable to download online, you can get an audio CD at cost on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.